We're going to move quickly on to our last session before we head off, get our lunches, and go to the zoo. We have infectious disease doctors coming up. You know, while they're coming up, let me take an opportunity to do some housekeeping. All of you need to have a map of the zoo. This is critical. The map has a sticker on it that has a color, yellow, red, or blue. Depending upon the color sticker, that will determine which of the second animal exhibits you will be going to. So please, if you have misplaced your map, if you don't have a map, take a map as you leave. The map will show you how to get from the health center, which is where we are starting, to either the rhino with the squamous cell carcinoma, the lion who had cardiac tamponade, or the guenon who has the endocrine disorders. So make sure if you don't have a map, you get one. All right, we're going to start our last section, infectious disease. We have today Dr. Stephen Bartold. Actually, I'm going to go ahead and introduce everyone in advance, and then they'll proceed. Dr. Stephen Bartold, who is the Distinguished Professor of Veterinary and Medical Pathology, Director of the Center for Comparative Medicine at UC Davis School of Medicine and Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Jane Sykes, who is Professor of Small Animal Internal Medicine, Department of Veterinary Medicine and Epidemiology, and at UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. And Dr. Claire Panosian Donovan, who is Professor of Medicine Infectious Disease, UCLA Program in Global Health, and the past president of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. And we will start with Dr. Sykes.
Thanks very much, Dr. Nadison Horowitz. I also want to thank Dr. Conrad and Dr. Nadison Horowitz for inviting me to speak here. It's really great to be here. I think this is fantastic. Really enjoying it so far. I also think it's a wonderful way for medical and veterinary students to learn in this sort of case-driven way. So I hope that we're doing this again in the future. Let's see if I can get this up on the screen. No? Give it a minute. Okay, so just while we're waiting for it to come up, just to let you know, I have a 50% clinical appointment at the Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital. I'm a small animal internal medicine specialist with an interest in infectious diseases. We don't actually have formal clinical infectious disease training or specialization for veterinarians, which is remarkable, really. And we're working on that through this relatively new society, the International Society for Companion Animal Infectious Diseases, which is a new, also One Health type of initiative. So I also do infectious disease control for the small animal clinic and also the exotics and pocket pet avian clinic, and that is a really enjoyable part of my job, and I certainly get exposed to a lot of zoonotic diseases doing that. So my first case is going to be a dog with salmonellosis. And it's going to be a relatively short to the point presentation, and then we're actually going to go through six cases, three veterinary cases and three human cases. So this is Sammy, and I apologize for the quality of the image, but it truly is Sammy. And Sammy is a three-year-old malnutted German Shepherd dog mix. And he originally presented to one of our house offices for the primary problem of swollen joints. He saw his local vet back in July for swollen tarsal joints, and despite them they did a single joint tap and found no evidence of inflammation in the synovial fluid. They did some testing for vector-borne infectious diseases, all of which antibody titers to all of those diseases that are listed up there were negative. But despite that, they treated him somewhat empirically with tetracycline antimicrobials, and then they treated him with immunosuppressive doses of glucocorticoids for a presumed immune-mediated polyarthritis, which we see fairly commonly in dogs. And despite that therapy, he progressed to the point that He developed severe joint pain and became ultimately non-ambulatory 4 months after developing clinical signs and was referred to our teaching hospital. So a little bit more history on Sammy. And, you know, being an infectious disease person, I like to get into the nitty-gritties of what these animals do on a day-to-day basis, and I find out where they're from. And this dog had been receiving low doses of glucocorticoids for a diagnosis of atopic dermatitis since he was only 6 months of age. He lived on a farm in the Fresno area, and he had no known tick exposure, but he was known to have an interesting dietary history. He loved to ingest horse feces, very nice, and frequently ate dead wild animals, including a variety of reptile species. He did particularly like toads, according to the owner, and a variety of different avian species as well. And aside from that, he hadn't really traveled out of that Fresno area. And also interesting part of his history, and I think this is something that we as veterinarians should pay close attention to, is especially from an infectious disease standpoint, the occupations and health status of the owners. The owners were, one of them was a pediatrician, and the other was a critical care nurse who worked in a pediatric clinic. So on physical exam, the main findings were mild pyrexia. This is at UCD. He was recumbent, unable to stand. He was tachycardic. He had severe pain and joint effusion in multiple peripheral joints, as well as spinal and cervical pain. He had some slightly harsh lung sounds and also some changes consistent with his history of steroid administration, including an enlarged liver and a thin fur coat. His blood work showed a left shift with 1,500 bands. He had a mild regenerative anemia, he was hypoalbuminemic, and he had liver enzyme elevations that we see again in dogs that are receiving glucocorticoids. Dogs have a steroid-induced elevation of ALP, which is not seen in people, and a lot of human labs that process dog blood often get very surprised by this, but we see it quite commonly. And on urinalysis, he had an active sediment with many rods present. So some radiographs were taken, thoracic and spinal radiographs. They didn't find any abnormalities. Radiographs of multiple joints showed articular effusion, intra-articular effusion, and there was no evidence of subchondral bone loss, so consistent with a non-erosive polyarthropathy. Some infectious disease testing. These are organisms that, again, can cause polyarthritis in dogs. Bartonella serology and culture was negative. Coccidioides serology in Dr. Papagiannis' lab at UCD was negative. And multiple joint taps in all of the synovial fluid samples obtained. Marked increase in cell count, marked increase in neutrophil count in the synovial fluid, and many of the neutrophils contained intracellular rods. So because we diagnosed him based on these findings with a septic polyarthritis, we did go and look at his heart valves, because sometimes endocarditis can be associated with septic embolic polyarthritis in dogs. And the main finding, this is, and Dr. Kittleson can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is a left apical four-chamber view, and the main finding was a thickening of the posterior tricuspid valve and hyperechogenicity of the valve, and it was felt because of this dog's young age that this may be evidence of underlying endocarditis. So subsequently, we did cultures of his urine, blood, and synovial fluid, and from all of those samples, Salmonella arizonae was isolated, and it was a broadly susceptible Salmonella isolate, susceptible to multiple different antimicrobials. And so Sammy actually was hospitalized, this is him, in the ICU. He was really quite critical. He received aggressive treatment with fluids and colloids, parenteral antimicrobials. He was treated with parenteral fluoroquinolones. It actually did very, very well with that therapy. His glucocorticoids were obviously tapered and discontinued. Just shortly after, about a week after presentation, fecal blood and urine cultures were all negative. And then he came back a month later. He had a repeat echocardiogram, which showed some mild persistent thickening of that tricuspid valve leaflet. He had some repeat synovial fluid sampling performed, and there was just mild lymphocytic inflammation there. and synovial fluid, blood and urine cultures were again negative. So he went home. We didn't see him again until a year later when he came in to see our derm service because his atopic dermatitis had flared up off the glucocorticoids. So that's Sammy, and now Dr. Panosian is going to present a case.
All right, the trick is to switch over to the next set of slides. Does somebody do that for me, or do I get to do it? All right. There we go. And well, first let me say thank you all for being such a great audience, and thanks to the organizers for this one-of-a-kind event. There we go. Since we're doing three infectious diseases cases, my human cases will be fairly short, but I think they'll either provide, in this case, there's a lot of resonance with the veterinary case, and in other cases, maybe demonstrate some uniquely human foibles. You probably have, many of you, seen the latest issue of Emerging Infectious Diseases, which is the CDC journal, in which they estimated that there are 1 million human cases of salmonellosis in the U.S. every year. So we know that there is just an enormous burden of illness, most of which never does come to medical attention, rightfully, because people will often recover. In my world, I sometimes see large groups of people with salmonella. I was recently the consultant for an outbreak of 500 cases associated with some contaminated food in about 20 Head Start nurseries. This was written up by the local health department, if you're interested in the details. But when I was choosing a case for today, I thought I would go back to my early days as the chief of infectious diseases at one of our smaller county hospitals. And at that time, we had a cluster of cases due to a particular exposure. So this is just a very short summary of a man who presented to one of the county hospitals originally with a desquamating skin rash. Appropriately, the infectious disease doctors who saw him wanted to rule out certain infectious syndromes, such as a staphylococcal infection or toxic shock due to strep. And once they were satisfied that he did not have an underlying infection, he was treated with some empiric IV antibiotics, but also placed on steroids. So now you're hearing something kind of similar to the doggy that preceded, and he benefited from the steroids, except that about 2 weeks later, he was readmitted with fever and lower extremity swelling. And at that time, blood cultures were drawn and grew the same organism, Salmonella arizonae. On further questioning, the patient acknowledged that he had been taking rattlesnake pills that he had acquired from a traditional herbalist. And actually, he had taken these 1 year prior to his illness for the treatment of his chronic dermatitis. So now, since, in a way, you've received the dramatic point of the story, in the late 80s and 1990s in particular, if you go back to the medical literature, there were clusters of cases, often in people who were Hispanic, who would go to folk remedy pharmacias and take a desiccated form of rattlesnake powder for a variety of illnesses, including dermatologic, arthritis, cancer. I mean, in the series, you'll see all these different indications. And as we know, this particular organism, Salmonella arizonae, is part of the normal flora of a variety of reptiles. So this clearly was a self-induced infection in one sense. What's also interesting is the one-year latency. I think what we've often forgotten is that many people who are infected with salmonella do become chronic carriers, perhaps even as many as 3% of human infections. I don't know about animals. And in the series that were published, there were a number of cases where people had had this ingestion of the specific organism anywhere from a year to 4 years prior to their bacteremia. Clearly, in this case, the permissive factor was the use of steroids for the incidental dermatitis. So it's a nice, happy ending. The patient was treated with an antibiotic, at that time highly effective and still fortunately mainly effective, quinolone antibiotics. His systemic steroids were tapered and his topical steroids were continued. So we have a classic case of a patient with an immunosuppressed state, but with the interesting twist of having ingested a contaminated folk remedy containing salmonella. So maybe that'll trigger some conversation when we move to our discussion phase. Okay, salmonella done. Moving on to Lyme disease.
Well, Pat, I had an aha moment. I found out that I'm an obsessive compulsive grant writing veterinarian.
And very successful.
The introduction said, I direct the Center for Comparative Medicine at UC Davis, and we're a medical school, veterinary school joint program with MDs and DVMs researching animal models of human disease. And I come from Yale School of Medicine for 25 years before that. So I've lived in the medical world, and I continue to collaborate with physicians in my research on Lyme disease. So I decided to pick a case that is not typical, and that is what's in your notes, a Lyme disease in a horse. And I don't want you to go away with the impression that this is what Lyme disease looks like in a horse. And since I've been working on Lyme disease since its very discovery in Lyme, Connecticut, I've come to appreciate that you can have clinical syndromes ranging from totally subclinical infections, which are verified infections in both humans and animals, to very florid clinical signs and disease. And in fact, some of our species, like dogs, develop fatal consequences with what looks like an immune complex nephropathy. So this horse is at that extreme end of the spectrum of being a very unusual case. And to illustrate that Lyme disease can come in all sorts of unexpected ways. And so the case I wanted to present is a slow horse with gluteal muscle atrophy that is asymmetric. And it had a history of a number of neurologic signs and behavioral abnormalities. It came from an area that is hyperendemic for Lyme borreliosis in New Jersey, and the horse was moved to Livermore, California. And when it came to California, its clinical course continued. And so in New Jersey, veterinarians tried to figure out what was going on. They performed serology for Lyme borreliosis multiple times and submitted serum to multiple laboratories, and they were consistently seronegative. That is unusual for Lyme disease. A high item on the differential list was equine protozoal myeloencephalitis caused by sarcocystis, a la Pat Conrad, who is responsible for its discovery. And it's a rather serious neurologic syndrome in horses. And that turned out to be quasi-positive, enough to make the clinicians at least think that they could treat for that. And so they gave it successive rounds of treatment directed at that particular disease. I'm not a clinician, I'm a pathologist, so I'll just kind of skip through that. But I always have the right answer at the end as a pathologist. So the clinical course of this animal was mild or equivocal improvement with those treatments. It continued to go downhill when it was in California, staring into space, spooking, severe depression, head and neck tremor. Finally, with large animals, when they go down, it's pretty much a terminal thing. So the horse was euthanized and sent to the California Animal Health and Food Safety Laboratory. That is a diagnostic laboratory that serves the state of California in multiple locations. The main headquarters are in Davis. The horse came to Davis, and full necropsy was performed, but at the gross necropsy, they found very florid changes in the meninges of the brain all the way down the spinal cord. Severe meningoradiculoneuritis, as we see here in this histology. And as a comparative pathologist, I felt that this was reminiscent of very severe tertiary neurosyphilis in its characteristics in retrospect in this case. And it's interesting that Borrelia burgdorferi is a close cousin of Treponema pallidum, the agent of syphilis. But Lyme disease is the socially acceptable spirochetal disease. So during the course of the diagnostic workup, they tried heroically to culture bacteria and fungi, did immunohistochemistry for a number of potential agents of neurotropic nature. Everything was consistently negative. So the pathologist was at a total loss in this case. What he did find as a final desperate attempt was to do a silver stain on the central nervous system tissues. And lo and behold, he found spirochetal forms in the tissue. Of course, one must think of Leptospira. Horses do not get syphilis. So he went into the literature and found that there was a similar horse case in the United Kingdom with a very florid meningoencephalitis. And it was speculated that it was associated with Lyme disease in the horse. So he then contacted me because I work on Lyme disease in the laboratory. And we said, sure, we have a specific immune serum. We can do immunohistochemistry, do a quick read to see if anything comes up. And lo and behold, we found the classic pattern of Borrelia in tissues. You can see individual organisms, but then kind of over on the right in the middle, you see this blurry blob, which is characteristic of Borrelia. It forms microcolonies within collagen. I don't know of any other agent that does that. And in fact, that's a mechanism by which Borrelia evades host immunity, is sequestration within collagen. So it looked pretty good for borreliosis, even though the serology didn't fit. So we did a PCR. We probed for a number of Borrelia burgdorferi specific targets. They all came up positive, which prompted us to amplify and sequence outer surface protein A, C, and flagellin B with 99.9% identity to Borrelia burgdorferi 297, which parenthetically is a isolate from a human neuroborreliosis case in the East Coast. So pretty convincing that this is truly a very weird, atypical manifestation of Lyme borreliosis. And I want to use the case as a reminder that the clinical manifestations of Lyme disease are extremely varied. Like syphilis was originally called the great imitator, Lyme disease many years ago was called the second great imitator. Dogs don't get symptoms, or animals don't get symptoms. They get signs, so we don't know of the full ramifications in animals. But the classic Lyme disease pattern of arthritis, cardiac conduction defects, et cetera, occur in dogs, occur in horses, occur in cows, occur in people. So there's commonality in all of that. But as I said, the manifestations are quite diverse. And why would this horse be similar to a horse in the United Kingdom with this rare manifestation, both areas that were hyperendemic for Lyme disease? Why wouldn't we see more of this? And we suspect that this horse actually had another rare syndrome called combined variable immunodeficiency, in which horses are B-cell deficient. And since the immune response to Borrelia is very much antibody-mediated, serology should have been positive if this animal was indeed immunocompetent. This form of immunodeficiency in horses arises in adulthood, and usually they have trouble with bacteria. Serology for Lyme disease is not standardized. It's not perfect, but it is pretty good. And so In the case of humans, if you're immunocompetent, you should be most certainly seropositive. And then we have the issue of post-Lyme disease syndrome. The Infectious Disease Society of America recognizes that after a human patient is treated for Lyme borreliosis, a number of patients go on to have persistent symptoms, very, very subjective symptoms, most commonly cognitive defects, fatigue, et cetera, that nobody really knows what the cause of it is. That is it an aftermath of the previous infection, or is it continued persistence of Borrelia? And in the laboratory, we're finding that Borrelia does indeed persist after antibiotic treatment. So that's it for me, and Claire, you can take me down with your comments if you want.
I don't have to tell this audience that few diseases have aroused as much emotional angst as Lyme disease. And the true expert just spoke with you, but it certainly is an emerging infectious disease. I was a fellow in Boston in the early 80s when it was just, you know, being described, and we did see many of the later manifestations at that time, and as well as acute infections. When I moved to California, of course, I didn't expect to see too much Lyme disease in Southern California. This is an area where we wouldn't see too much naturally, although, of course, the reservoir can expand, and maybe that will change. Northern California is different. But what I began to see were many patients who were carrying a misdiagnosis of Lyme disease. So I thought I would share one case like that. This was a woman who actually carried the diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis after she was in her 30s, and after the birth of her second child, she developed some fairly characteristic changes on her hand x-rays and had a rheumatoid factor which was markedly positive, and was treated appropriately with anti-inflammatory agents for about 10 years. And then, as is a very human and understandable instinct, was hoping that she might have a different disease that might be less chronic and more amenable to eradication. And at that time, we had a number of doctors in this area, not a number, a handful, who specialized in Lyme disease, and she was seen by such a doctor and started on a continuous regimen of antibiotics that went on over 4 years, often taking two oral antibiotics at the same time. I have even seen a couple patients who've been on continuous IV antibiotics for a year or two for a diagnosis of Lyme disease. She did continue to have generalized fatigue and joint pain. Her pertinent history is maybe not entirely relevant, but she did have childhood strep throats into her 20s. We, in infectious disease, are always looking for that rare case of adult strep-induced rheumatologic disease, but no other family disease of autoimmune disorder except that she had a child with diabetes. She was a native of Kansas. She had spent 4 summers in Connecticut, which, of course, would place her at risk. I'm not trying to judge this patient. I'm just telling the facts as they presented to me. She did not have a history of tick bites or erythema chronic migrans, and she worked in the entertainment industry. On physical examination, there was not too much of note, a slim, you know, very alert and lively woman, normal vital signs, but with very characteristic findings in her hands suggesting rheumatoid arthritis with swan neck deformities of the wrists and fusiform swelling of joints in the fingers and reduced range of motion in her shoulders and her C-spine. At her request, we repeated her Lyme serologies and a few other tests.
She had an elevated sed rate of 50. Otherwise, the blood count was normal. Her rheumatoid factor was, again, markedly positive. Her Lyme ELISA was well under the normal cutoff. Her IFA was at the cutoff. And a Western blot, which was performed in Palo Alto, was interpreted as negative for antibody to Borrelia. So at that point, she was hoping, I think, for some corroboration, maybe some guidance, and with a great deal of empathy and understanding, I and others tried to explain to her that we did not think that she had Lyme disease and that she should continue to receive aggressive therapy for her rheumatoid arthritis. We had some x-rays, but somehow they didn't make it, that would show you the fairly classic erosive changes of rheumatoid arthritis. Maybe you'll have questions about this. I mean, there has been a lot of controversy around the even the case that was brought by the state attorney in Connecticut against the Infectious Diseases Society of America, questioning the guidelines that were established by human experts in Lyme disease, stating that there was no benefit to these extremely prolonged courses of antibiotics. At the same time, laws have been passed in several states, including California, which make it possible for some practitioners to do this. So maybe we can turn to the veterinary community. I think we definitely need more surveillance of Lyme disease in certain areas, such as California. Animals might be a very interesting population in which to look for it. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Okay, so our last infectious disease is TB. I have to tell you a story that maybe makes you laugh about this crossover between veterinarians and humans when it comes to infectious diseases. We're in Australia over the Christmas period, and all of my three children, I have three kids under seven, they all developed pinworms, and it really ruined our holiday. But we came back, and we went to our pediatrician with them, and I was explaining to him what happened, and I said, so we dewormed everybody, and then he just burst into laughter, and he's like, we don't normally use that term when we're talking about humans. All right, so the next case is a dog called Shasta. And Shasta is with us no longer, unfortunately. This is not going to have a good outcome. And Dr. Dickinson put the little blindfold on his dog, but what I will say about having animal patients is it's really convenient if you want to put a picture of your patient in a talk. There's always the internet to find an animal that looks very, very like the one that you're talking about. So this is not actually Shasta, but a dog that looks very much like Shasta. And Shasta's main complaint was coughing. And Shasta's owners took her to her local vet with a two-month history of an intermittent cough that was occasionally productive and occurred multiple times a day. She had progressive lethargy and her appetite was reduced, and occasional vomiting over that period of time. She had a history of urinary tract infections prior to that, which had been treated with fluoroquinolone antimicrobials. And her local veterinarian did some blood work, which they found no abnormal findings at that time. They did some chest radiographs, which showed marked consolidation of her right cranial lung lobe, and she had some evidence of lymph node enlargement in her perihilar region. And they, again, kind of empirically treated her with amoxicillin, and the owners reported no improvement in response to that, and so she was referred to UC Davis. So again, a little bit more background history, doing infectious disease stuff, so we've got a lot of interest in what goes on at home. She was obtained from a Golden Retriever rescue program about a year prior to the onset of this cough. She lived with some goldfish and a huge number of parakeets. She denied any tobacco, ethanol, or drug use. She had no history of tick exposure that was known, and she had not traveled outside of California since being obtained but we didn't know whether there had been any travel history prior to her being rescued, and we never really were able to find that information out. So on physical exam, again, this dog was mildly pyrexic. She was somewhat overweight, actually, despite her decreased appetite, and she had some harsh lung sounds diffusely. Blood work, the main findings were azotemia. She had an increased creatinine and BUN. She had poorly concentrated urine, so consistent with renal failure, and increased numbers of white cells in her urine and many rods. An aerobic urine culture was positive for Klebsiella pneumoniae, that again was a susceptible organism. So these are her thoracic radiographs, and I'm glad that there's already been some dog thoracic radiographs for the MDs in the audience to kind of get orientated on. But this is a lateral thoracic radiograph. So forelimb is here, humerus is here, and then this is her spine here. This is trachea here, and her cardiac silhouette here, which is somewhat obscured by this marked consolidation of her right cranial lung lobe. And you can see some air bronchograms here. And then she had perihilar opacity that was thought to be consistent either with an enlarged hilar lymph node or some sort of juxtahilar mass. So an ultrasound was done of her abdomen, and no abnormal findings were found there. She was tested for coccidioidomycosis. Again, we do see cocci in dogs quite commonly. It's probably our most common fungal disease of dogs in the Northern California region, and she had no positive antibody titer to coccidioides. And then some aspirates, fine needle aspirates, were taken of the consolidated lung lobe, and you can see the main findings here. She had sort of scattered vacuolated histiocytes or macrophages here, a few lymphocytes, and then a few of these cholesterol crystals were present, and then there were some atypical-looking epithelial cells, and so there was a concern written in her report for possible underlying epithelial neoplasia, and the owners at that point in time decided not to go any further. They didn't want to do further diagnostics, and they took her home, and she was treated again with broad-spectrum antimicrobials, and amazingly enough, she actually did better on those antimicrobials, which again included a fluoroquinolone. And then after those were discontinued, her cough returned. That was 8 months later, and they decided to do more workup, including a CT and a thoracotomy. So this is just a few images from her CT scan here. Again, this is her cardiac silhouette here, left lung lobe over here. Her right lung lobe was very consolidated and atelectic. She also had some lymph nodes that were partially mineralized, and that was not appreciated on the thoracic radiographs. And then going more caudally, she had some of these sort of multifocal stellate opacities, and all of these findings were thought to be consistent with a chronic granulomatous pneumonia. So then she went to surgery for a lung biopsy. Unfortunately, our surgeons decided to wear N95 high-density surgical masks because they were worried about a zoonotic disease. And they took biopsies and did impression smears of the biopsies. There were low numbers of neutrophils present, and then retrospectively, we did an acid-fast stain on the impression smears, and rare acid-fast bacilli were present, and cultures for aerobic, anaerobic, fungal, and mycoplasma organisms were all negative. So this is the histopath, and really dramatic changes on histopath. These multifocal granulomas that were effacing the lung parenchyma that was submitted, and also the lymph nodes. You can see these granulomas here. In the center of the granulomas, there was some necrosis, a layer of epithelioid macrophages, a thick layer of fibrosis, and then an outer layer of histiocytes, plasma cells, and lymphocytes. And so we were very concerned about the possibility of a tuberculous mycobacterial infection. And then this is a FITE stain here, FITEs, I think we did Zeal-Nielsen as well, and you can see acid-fast bacteria present. This is a high-powered view. You can just appreciate these elongated pink staining bacteria. So we then took samples over to a Tupper Hall, and we did some PCR for mycobacterial species. The bottom line was at multiple different laboratories, the tissue samples were PCR positive for an organism belonging to the MTB complex, And at National Jewish Laboratories in Denver, they isolated Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which was characterized phenotypically, and it was a broadly susceptible organism. And we then went further and we did some molecular typing on that isolate, and we found that it was Mycobacterium tuberculosis that belonged to the Beijing Spiliga type, or type 1, which is a very aggressive, easily transmitted strain that can be resistant to multiple antimicrobial drugs. So we recommended actually euthanasia of this dog because of public health concerns, but the owners decided that they wanted to try treatment. And so she was treated with isoniazid, rifampin, and clarithromycin. But shortly after starting isoniazid, she began seizuring, and that's one of the known adverse effects of isoniazid in dogs. And at that point, the owners just decided they'd had enough, and they decided to put her down. And we recommended that they sought medical attention themselves. There was a diabetic kid in the household, and she was sleeping with the dog and had been throughout this period of time. But quite amazingly, all the skin testing on the family was negative. The public health department was notified by us, and actually 57 students and staff at the VMTH had to be tested. They were all the people that had contacted the dog during its hospitalization, and then it was recommended that they come back 3 months later for additional testing. So a very rare case. I mean, this is an extremely rare disease in dogs, but definitely crossover between animals and humans, really important zoonotic disease, and we'll perhaps get into more of that during the discussion.
That is a sad story, and actually I'm intrigued to know why isoniazid, which I must say we give in abundance to humans, both those who are just positive on a skin test or actually have clinical disease with tuberculosis. We don't run into problems too often sometimes. So this is a happier story. A lady that I still see 13 years after this illness. She actually was in her 70s when she came to see me the first time, and she knew that she had had pulmonary tuberculosis in the 1940s. At that time, if you know your antimicrobial history, there was really only one drug for tuberculosis, the injectable drug streptomycin. Isoniazid became available in the 1950s and was a revolutionizing drug, and then, of course, many others followed. So this lady actually remained healthy and in a rested state with pulmonary tuberculosis, non-contagious, for about 50 years. In 1997, she noted the gradual onset of pleuritic chest pain, dry cough, low-grade fever, and a 10-pound weight loss. I'm not sure she even revealed that she had been treated for tuberculosis at the beginning of her illness because she didn't make the association. But very shortly after she became sick, she had a CT of her chest, which showed both pleural and pericardial effusions. She had a thoracentesis, which had high protein, predominantly a lymphocytic cellular count, and was culture negative. It was cultured for everything. I'm sure you know that the pleural fluid often is not culture positive, whereas pleural biopsies are more likely to be positive for TB. She was started empirically on INH, rifampin, and ethambutol, but 3 months later, she was admitted to the hospital with dizziness, tachycardia, and inspiratory chest pain. At that time, she was fatigued but alert and oriented. She still had a fever, 37.8. She had a rather lowish blood pressure and was definitely orthostatic. I'm sorry to tell Dr. Tillich, if he's still here, that I didn't see any evidence of people testing for a pulsus paradoxicus, which we had to do when I was a resident, but that was before CT scans. Her O2 saturation was somewhat low. Pertinent positives include dullness and decreased breath sounds, one-third of the way up in her left posterior chest. Obviously, she still had fluid. No murmurs or rubs were described, no peripheral edema. Laboratory findings included a hemoglobin of 10.8, a hematocrit of 33, elevated white count, not too specific, echocardiogram, a small pericardial effusion with some possible thickening, a large left pleural effusion, which had been evident on her physical exam. And ultimately, she had an MRI of her heart, which showed dilation of the inferior vena cava, right atrial enlargement, and a focal patch of pericardial thickening compatible with pericardial constriction. TB pericarditis used to be one of the most elusive diagnoses until, of course, modern-day imaging. And that is what she had, and despite good antimicrobial treatment, she was one of those patients in whom a surgical procedure is necessary. She did have a pericardial stripping procedure. The pathology of the tissue by then was stain and culture negative, but it was granulomatous and certainly consistent with tuberculosis. It was not easy keeping her. She had a variety of intolerances to some of the TB meds, but she was ultimately treated with, actually it was more than 9 months, of three drugs. And 13 years later, she is now in her mid-80s. She remains well, lives independently at home. And this, of course, is reactivation tuberculosis in a fairly dramatic form. We know that a third of the world's population has been exposed to tuberculosis, and that many of them will contain their infections and present later in life. The good news for those patients, at least, is that they very often have drug-sensitive strains as opposed to people who will become newly infected in the coming years, in whom we are very worried about more and more drug-resistant strains. And we think of TB as, you know, a primarily human infection, although clearly animals do acquire other species. And it will be very interesting to think a little bit about how this dog was exposed to tuberculosis. So we'll leave it there, and I guess now we move on to your questions and some discussion. Thank you.
Pulsus paradoxicus.
Actually, that's a great foreshadowing. What we're gonna hear about the diagnosis of cardiac tamponade prior to an echocardiogram, or the fact that it was high on the differential diagnosis of the veterinarians based on non-imaging factors. I'm going to let Dr. Panosian and Syke and Bartold kind of take away the conversation and accept questions from the audience, except that I want to say that of all of the medical subspecialties, I would say probably there's more engagement between veterinarians and internal medicine doctors around infectious disease concerns. I think you interface much more than the rest of us. So,
well, first of all, I have to say thank you again to Pat Conrad for her incredible talk, and she really touched upon emerging infectious diseases where it's been a mandatory collaboration between vets and infectious disease specialists. We talked about some pretty classic infectious diseases in our segment, but there is an infinite potential for more surveillance, collaboration, so I think we all welcome that.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Well, we maybe should open two questions,
sure.
Unless you'd like to make more comments about, I think that my cases speak for themselves. You want to make any additional points?
I guess the point that I'd like to make about TB, I said it's a really rare disease in dogs. When we see mycobacterial diseases in dogs, it's usually Mycobacterium avium infections, and there's thought to be some sort of cell-mediated immune defect in those dogs. It's very, very uncommon. There's only a handful of canine case reports in the literature. And the disease is thought to be a reverse zoonosis, so a disease, that infectious disease that travels from people to dogs. And in, I think, only one or two of the cases in the literature, they actually were able to isolate the organism from the dog and the human. They showed that they did typing to show that the strains were identical.
Would you like to say anything more?
He could talk for two hours
yeah. about Lyme disease. In mouse models and the unfinished research agenda, but...
Well, in the laboratory where we're doing this, we're finding that mice, rats, hamsters, guinea pigs, gerbils, dogs, monkeys, and probably people, if we want to be comparative, a persistent infection for life is the rule, not the norm, with Borrelia. And the later you treat we know this from human clinical studies, the more difficult it is to cure a patient of clinical signs of Lyme borreliosis and probably infection. And what we're finding is that Borrelia, during persistent infection, hunkers down, doesn't divide, and as a result, is tolerant to the effects of antibiotics. So the tolerance phenomenon is different than resistance. We all know of antibiotic resistance. Tolerance is multi-drug based, and it's because you have a subpopulation of dormant, non-dividing bacteria, analogous to what you see with biofilms and implanted devices and so on. You can't often cure a patient with an infected biofilm unless you remove that structure and start all over again. That's tolerance, because you have these dormant forms of bacteria, which are genetically identical, but they come back out after you remove the antibiotics. We're seeing something similar to that, not that Borrelia forms biofilms, but there is a resurgence of growth in tissues in the mouse model. I think we need to be open-minded about this thing called post-Lyme disease syndrome that the medical community recognizes but doesn't understand, and that's why you need basic studies to do that.
Okay. Questions?
I know we have a hard stop in 10 minutes.
We do.
Try to get as many as possible. Who wants to start?
Hi, my name is Christine Yi. I'm a veterinary cardiologist. I'm doing translational studies for human. And this is kind of taking a separate direction, so it's more talking as clinicians and researchers. But I've learned that it goes lab animal medicine to human medicine to veterinary medicine, and then we glean what we can from human medicine. And I think this discussion is awesome because I think that means we can put, like, animals and humans together and both benefit one from another. But I was wondering how we have a wealth of models now. How do we actually take the next step and use it? Like, how do you envision it? Because, like, does that mean that once we have the animal models, great, the human researchers go to the animals and say, hey, we have this drug, can we use it on your dogs? Or, like, how do you see it collaborating besides just the mind mesh?
Well, I can answer that.
Sure.
The key word here is model. They're not exactly, they're a model of the disease that occurs in humans, but not necessarily exactly the same. And I think it's just as important to understand the commonality of things as the differences. That we have species-based differences, for example, the susceptibility of dogs to a nephropathy syndrome in Lyme borreliosis. We don't see that in people. So there's information gained from both sides. But what animal models in the laboratory do is let you form a rational hypothesis that you can then take to the clinical situation and try. Giving people antibiotics for a year or 2 years for Lyme disease has no rational basis to it whatsoever. People are desperately trying to do the best they can, but it's not rational. So you have to do the controlled studies in a laboratory animal system, work it out, give it a try in humans, and see if it works better.
Jane and Clara, I have to say I was totally unnerved by this Salmonella Arizona case that you presented. We all know Salmonella typhimurium, is a big concern, especially having to do with eggs and foodborne disease and all. But now more and more people, my son and his girlfriend included, have lizards as pets, which they play with, maybe sleep with, eat with. I've heard stories. And one just tested was Salmonella Arizona, which I thought, as you indicated, was normal flora, only rarely a zoonotic threat. So now, what would you say to animal owners who have a very close relationship with their reptile pets if they test positive for Salmonella Arizona and the animals are perfectly normal? What would be your advice in terms of the zoonotic risk?
Well, my first reaction is there's nothing new under the sun, because reptile-associated, turtle-associated, snake-associated salmonella infection has been known
for a long time. The good news, I suppose, is that many humans have minor salmonella infections that don't require diagnosis or treatment. But it, you know, living in proximity with reservoir animals is a risk. And if it's an immunocompromised host, you know, that could be very bad news. And I think that this is the ongoing education that the public needs from both.
We were at a very prestigious museum in Northern California a few years ago, and I had all my little children who were even younger than they are now, and I was taking them into the museum, and in the lobby of the museum there was a guy there who had an iguana draped over his shoulders and on his head, and all these kids were coming up to look at the iguana, and I was like, control, I'm not going to say anything.
Right.
And then we went and looked at the museum. Then we went down to the cafeteria, and he was down there in the cafeteria with the iguana on the table and all these kids, you know, under five, sitting around petting the iguana. I was like, okay, can't control it anymore. So I went to the security guard, and I was like, you need to get the guy out of the cafe with the iguana.
Pet-associated infections will keep us ID folks in business for a while, I would say.
You know, I had a similar thing when my brother took my family, when my daughter was very young, to a petting zoo, and the goats had contagious eczema, which is a zoonotic disease, and I freaked. You know, and my brother says, "Oh, you're overprotective," and all of that. But yeah, zoonotic diseases are prevalent and so on. But just keep in mind that you're more apt to get an infection from the person next to you than you are the animals.
But one of the points that I just like to throw in is that most practicing physicians don't have the name of a veterinarian to call other than maybe their dog's vet. I'm wondering, how often are you contacted by human physicians, and what types of docs call you?
I talk to human physicians relatively frequently, I think, for a veterinarian. I actually often get calls about Lyme from physicians. I get calls about people with chronic fatigue syndromes who believe they're infected with some sort of zoonotic disease. My laboratory actually works on hemotropic mycoplasma infections, which we've known infect animals for a very long time and are now being discovered in immunocompromised people as well. I often get calls about people who think that they might have one of those infections too. So I talk to physicians fairly frequently.
I think Emily Beeler has a question.
Avian chlamydiosis. Yeah, I don't do much. I think probably the exotics people do more of that than I do. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, how often is the case for an infectious disease physician to ask not just what animals have you been exposed to, but how healthy are those animals? So, for example, you have an ill person in front of you, and if it so happens that dog was recently diagnosed with certain tick-borne disease, and that diagnosis may already be established, it could shorten your job.
Well, I have no way of knowing. I think infectious disease people do like asking those questions about at least animal exposure, but taking it to the next step, probably not too often.
We actually saw a cat with sporothrix, really severe sporothrix infection yesterday. Yesterday would be the day before yesterday, and its whole face was distorted with, you know, cutaneous masses, and there were organisms all over the slide, and, you know, you can handle these cats and get infected without any breaks in your skin. And the owners really hadn't caught on to the idea that they should be wearing gloves when they're handling this cat. And after multiple veterinarians had said, you need to be really careful, they're like, oh, we're starting to worry a little bit about our own health. And the dermatology resident told me that she'd seen a dog with it. And the dog's owner, the wife, said, oh, my husband's got all these lesions all up his arm. And the guy was like, no, you don't want to look at those. And then she pulls up his sleeve and he's got, you know, sporothrix suspected up, crawling up his arm. She's like, you need to go and see your doctor about that. He's like, oh, no, it's just spider bites. And she's like, no, you really should go and see your doctor about that.
Dr. Jonna Mazet would like to ask a question.
I'm over here. Hi, I'm a veterinary epidemiologist from UC Davis, and I run a TB project, a bovine TB project in Tanzania. And I work there with the School of Public Health, the veterinary school, and their equivalent of the NIH. And we bemoan as a group the lack of awareness of extrapulmonary TB and bovine TB in humans, and that it's not examined or looked for
there. And I wonder if I could ask you here, especially in Southern California, especially with the Latino and migrant populations, how often do you see or do you look for extrapulmonary TB?
We see a lot of it. Actually, when I was at county hospital, we would see TB in every organ, and we would look for it because we were sensitized. But I would agree with you that it isn't a knee-jerk reaction, you know, when you see unexplained sterile pyuria, to think of TB of the kidney, or a woman who may have a chronic endometritis, to think of TB of the endometrium. We sometimes will see people who have intestinal TB, who grew up in a place where they had exposure to non-pasteurized dairy products. I've seen that in several people who are from natives of India. But I think that your point is still very well taken, that there are all of these different manifestations that we should be
in different organisms
teaching over and over. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is absolutely fascinating. I'm going to have to stop the conversation, but then we'll restart the conversation on the bus and while we're strolling through the zoo. If everyone can kind of pay attention, because we're going to need to move quickly. It is 1 o'clock, and wait. I have to give you the directions. It's 1 o'clock. We want to board buses at 1:15. This is what the map looks like. On the map, there is the colored dot that I discussed. Okay, here's what's going to happen. We are going to get up, go out, grab box lunches, do whatever you need to do, but be on one of the buses, which will be boarding on the westward side of Ronald Reagan as you entered, if you entered from that side. And buses will leave at 1:15. If you are driving yourself, which we're strongly discouraging, but some people may be, your badge will serve as admission to the zoo. And when you arrive at the entrance to the zoo, you're going to need to hoof it up to the top. There should be some docents and folks there who can show you where to go. When you get to the top of this map, the health center is actually north of what appears on the map. The health center is off of the map, and our tour begins there. For those who take the bus, here's what will happen. The buses will arrive, and the first group of buses will offload. That group of people will walk up a hill to the condor display, and we'll learn about lead toxicity in condors. The other half will first tour the health center, and they have some nice things there. After about a half an hour, the groups will switch, and we have docents there and some timekeepers to tell you what the time is, but it's up to the DVMs and MDs here. We're a smart, hardy group, to be quick and move, because we have a lot of spots to hit. The groups will switch, and then we'll land at the, there's a launching area, and the times are on your schedule in the syllabus, where we will all meet. At that point, the group divides into three based on this color dot. If you have a blue dot, you'll be seeing the Gwenon, who has the endocrine problem, who had a pancreatitis. If you have a red dot, you'll be seeing the lion with tamponade. If you have a yellow dot, it's the rhino who had squamous cell carcinoma. Each of those exhibits will take about 45 minutes or so. There is some walking there, and that will end, and we will all meet at the Cambodian pavilion for Dr. Ettinger's concluding comments. There will also be a cocktail reception and some things to eat there. The UC Davis faculty, there's a special bus, and I think for the students as well, to be taken to the airport to make that flight that many of you are on. For the rest of the folks who are staying, there'll be two buses that will be leaving the zoo, one at 5:45 and one at 6:15. It's all in the syllabus if you forget any of the things I said, but the critical thing is to take a look at the dot. And when you open up the map will show you. So if you are blue and you're going to the Gwenon, the map shows you from the health center, this launching area, to the Gwenon, how to do that. And the same thing is true if you have a red or a yellow dot. All right, I'm going to stop talking. Just one other thing. The zoo is open to the public today, and attendance is at an all-time high. So there will be kids running around and other folks who may join us. So we just ask that you be tolerant, but move quickly. Try to stay on the schedule. If you miss something, just look at your syllabus and join us at the next event. All right. I want to thank the faculty who were fantastic. I'm overwhelmed. It was absolutely spectacular. Thank you.